This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
Malcolm Muggeridge once said that the plainest fact of human existence is the one that we most steadfastly avoid facing. This is a case of corporate denial. The most obvious, the plainest fact of human existence is human mortality. We're all ineluctably, irresistibly, inevitably moving toward an encounter with death. Death is ultimate suffering. And so, one means by which God seeks to shatter the illusion of human divinity is by bringing us starkly face-to-face with the reality of our own mortality. Samuel Johnson said, if you've just heard you're going to be hanged in a fortnight, that has a way of focusing the mind. And you're lying in a hospital bed, and the doctor tells you, in all candor, that your cancer is terminal, and you have about 2 weeks to live. That's one way in which the illusion of human divinity, immortality, deity, divinity, imperishability is shattered. Clay. Yeah. How many thousands of people arose in this very morning but will not live to see nightfall? And most of them with no anticipation that it's going to happen. One other quote from Lewis before we come to the next point. Pain removes the veil. It plants the flag of truth within the fortress of a rebel soul. Pain removes the veil. It plants the flag of truth within the fortress of a rebel soul. And then secondly, the illusion of human self-sufficiency. This is closely related to the first because if you are self-deified, you're obviously self-sufficient. This is a more subtle danger, especially for those who intellectually at least acknowledge the reality of God. The problem here is that God is viewed as an emergency ration rather than a staple diet. There's that marvelous scene near the beginning of Shakespeare's play, The Tempest. The sailors cry out amid the tempest, "All is lost! To prayers, all is lost!" You know, prayer is a last resort. It's hard for us to turn our thoughts to God when things are going well. Lewis says in this book that we regard God as an airman regards his parachute. Only there for an emergency. You don't want to be without your parachute as you soar aloft. But you don't really give it much thought until the plane starts nosediving. In such a case, some sort of suffering may provide a means by which the things we clutch, the things that preoccupy us, are snatched away so that we can discover the true riches. Again, that's why Lewis said to Sheldon Vanalken that the death of his wife, Davy, was a severe mercy. Sheldon Vanalken underwent terrible grieving over the loss of his wife, and he expresses his grief and sorrow poignantly in that book. But if Lewis is right, it was the mercy of God to take her, lest their relationship become idolatrous. The nature of the ultimate test is this. The creature is called to bear obedience for its own sake. This is intellectually the most painful test. To obey God for no other reason than that He commands it, in hope of no reward beyond the act of obedience. Is not that what God does in Genesis chapter 2, verses 16 and 17? Of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, you shall not eat, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For on the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. But there's no rationale beyond the command. As a parent says to a child, do this or that. Why? You do it because I have told you to do it. I'm not offering that as the best counsel in all circumstances. But here's the ultimate test. You obey God in the certainty that while you do not understand, you understand that He understands. Elizabeth Elliot, in her book, These Strange Ashes, recounts her experience working among the Colorado Indians in Ecuador. And her task was to reduce their language to writing. All of her notes from a period of 9 months is stolen. And God never offers an explanation for why He allowed this to happen. No doubt, as she reflects, that she has obeyed God. She went to work with those Indians at His commission. And yet all of the work, so to speak, goes up in smoke. I refer you back to the end of Screwtape letter number 8. I'll not repeat the quote, but the gist of it is, here is a person who looks all about him, sees no sign of God's presence or favor, asks why God has forsaken him, and doggedly obeys. Biblical examples. I give you three biblical examples. Number one, Abraham. He takes his son Isaac to the mountain, Genesis chapter 22, an act of bare obedience. Supreme example of trust and obedience joined together. He obeys the command of God, take your son, your only son Isaac, the son of promise, and offer him to me as a sacrifice. Joined to that obedience is Abraham's trust in God, based upon that programmatic text, Genesis 15, verse 6. Abram trusted God. Bear obedience for its own sake. Why would God, the author of life, command such a thing? God doesn't say. Nonetheless, Abraham obeys. Second example, Job. We learn something about the pact between Yahweh and Satan, but Job doesn't. The events of Job chapter 1 are hidden from view. And Job comes to the point where he obeys God, clings to God, when injustice appears to have been done. And in the end, if you'll notice, if you read that magnificent book, none of Job's questions are answered, even at the end. But the glorious revelation of Yahweh is enough for him. All the questions vanish in the presence of Yahweh. Third example, Jesus Himself, who obeys even or especially at the moment the Father abandons Him. Is not that the supreme example? my God, why have you abandoned me? Joel Niederhood said in a sermon I heard, that question is never answered. Because the answer would be, as it were, to cast pearls before swine. I'll tell you my theory. I believe Jesus meditated through the entirety of Psalm 22. The opening verse is quoted, not as a bare text, but as a window into the progress of that whole psalm. If you read the entirety of Psalm 22, you'll see that it goes from despair to victory, which helps to explain the following words from the cross. Tetelestai, it has been accomplished. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. Let us notice there that Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? He doesn't say, why has God forsaken me? Just as Job, if you have complaints to offer, offer them to God. The psalmist says, I say to God, my rock, why have you abandoned me? The lesson there is that even in the midst of suffering, when all hope appears to have vanished, you cling to your communion to the Father. Let me give you the exact quote, the exact reference on that verse from Psalms. Psalm 42, verse 9. I say to God, my rock, why have you forsaken me? Remembering the cry of dereliction from the cross, think of this. We are called to be conformed to the image of that very person. When Romans 8:29 speaks of our being conformed to the image of Christ, it is to the image of Christ crucified. We have His example of obedience to the Father, even in the face of abandonment. That is our model, together with those of Abraham and Job. With those examples in mind, listen to a statement from George MacDonald, which is quoted at the beginning of The Problem of Pain. The Son of God suffered unto the death, not that men might not suffer, but that their sufferings might be like His. You may have heard the statement of Teresa of Avila. She says to God amidst her suffering, if this is what you do to your friends, no wonder you have so few of them. Lewis's point is this. If we are to be conformed as the people of God to the image of Christ crucified, the problem of pain is not why Christians suffer so much, but why some Christian believers suffer so little. Some Christians go through their entire lives with relatively little suffering. That's the problem, says Lewis, not why some people should suffer after the manner of Job or Abraham or Teresa of Avila, or somebody like Elizabeth Elliot, who's now living with her third husband following the death of the first two. Some people experience pain. We view it, and we don't think we could possibly bear what they have borne. But, says Lewis, the really intriguing problem is why some Christians suffer so little. As a footnote to that, recalling our earlier discussion, the whole church is corporately to experience and to disclose that kind of suffering. The whole church is the bride of Christ. If I read Paul correctly, there should be something in the corporate experience of the church that's a mirror image of Christ crucified. Point 7, the centrality of the cross. I haven't been able to track this down. Maybe some of you could help me. I believe it's in The Problem of Pain where Lewis uses this image. It's there or somewhere, where he likens our view of life to the view of looking at a fabric through a magnifying glass. imagine one of those huge magnifying glasses such as Sherlock Holmes used. You place your glass over the fabric, and you discover that the fabric is crystal clear at the center of the glass and fuzzy around the edges. He says, that's the way we should look at life. In the center of your glass, you have the cross. And when you look at the cross, you know that God is both great and good. You know that God is mighty to save. And you know that God is good because He spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all. Romans 8:32. Indeed, Romans 8:18-39 would be one of the best Pauline texts to join to this illustration. You see the clarity of the cross in the center of your picture. You see fuzziness around the perimeter. There is much in our experience that baffles us, that perplexes us. Who of us will not go into the heavenly glory with thousands of questions unanswered? I don't understand why this happened. But if the cross is in the center, we can say, we know that all things will work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose. I quote to you in this regard Psalm 62, verses 11 and 12. One thing God has spoken, two things have I heard, that you, O God, are strong, and that you, O Lord, are loving. There it is. Psalm 62, verses 11 and 12. You, O God, are strong, and you, O God, are loving. The cross is our clearest answer thus far to the real problem of pain. That brings us to section 8, the self and the other. Three things to be noted here. First, the Father's many stories. C.S. Lewis says in many of his writings, notably in the Chronicles of Narnia, that the Heavenly Father has a different story to tell for each of His children. That's a marvelous thing to grab hold of. Remember the story, the scene in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader? Is it Lucy that goes in and discovers this magical book? Is it Lucy? And there she discovers two of her friends talking about her. And at another point, she sees something and asks and says, look, that's not your story, that's her story. We're reminded of that scene in John 21 where Peter and John both speak with the risen Christ. And John says, Peter turns and sees John following and says, Lord, what about him? And Jesus replies, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? Follow me. That's John's story. Your story is that you will die a martyr's death and glorify God in that very way, as my own crucifixion was the ultimate revelation of glory. We beheld His glory supremely in the cross. One of the sore temptations that we will face, why should my daughter be afflicted with cancer when my friend's daughter has just been named homecoming queen? We're always going to want a different story. That will feed our pride. Our story has to be the best. Our story must be on the bestseller list for 3 years. Jesus has a different story to tell for each of His people. We trust the Father's providence. Suffering distributed. I remember being helped by this when there was an earthquake in Guatemala. I think we could apply it to what happened in Oklahoma City on April the 19th, 1995. Now, there's suffering provoked by human wickedness. Some suffering is not directly. An earthquake in San Francisco. We may be tempted to say there's an element of judgment in an earthquake, but we don't have apostolic and prophetic insight to say for sure how that's figuring in. The point is this. We watch the nightly news, and the totality of these disasters sweeps over us. But, says Lewis, let's remember that no one person experiences the totality of the disaster. If 1,000 people are killed, you have families in the thousands who grieve over the loss. And yet that suffering, the totality of the suffering, is distributed among them and not crushing down any one of them in its totality. And then suffering shared. Here is one of the most intriguing ideas from Lewis on this score. And here again, it's an image of Christ's own suffering. At this point, Lewis was strongly influenced by the thought of Charles Williams, a fellow member of the Inklings, one of Lewis's closest friends, an editor with Oxford University Press. Williams impressed upon Lewis the idea of voluntarily taking on someone else's suffering. Substitution. Here's something to ponder. Jesus Christ stood in our place, in our stead, as our representative. Is there a sense in which, within our corporate experience of suffering, one may take upon himself in another's stead a kind of suffering? The supreme example, of course, is Aslan taking suffering upon himself in the place of Edmund the traitor. In Till We Have Faces, how many of you have read that? Until We Have Faces, Psyche was all but unscathed by her ordeal because Orwell had borne most of the anguish. We go back to Colossians 1:24 on Paul's filling up in his flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's affliction for the sake of his body, the church. Just ponder this. How much suffering, intellectual and spiritual, were the Corinthians spared because Paul had borne it in their place? There's a concrete example from Lewis's own life, and some of you know what I'm about to say. During the time after Joy Davidman contracted cancer, Lewis was her nurse, and Lewis developed severe bone trouble, osteoporosis. His housekeeper thought that was the effect of his repeatedly lifting his wife's body and transferring her from one place to another. Lewis's view was different. He believed that when Joy was recovering from her first cancer, her riddled bones were regaining needed calcium at the same time that his were strangely losing it. The film Shadowland says nothing about this, but Lewis was convinced that there was a direct connection between the absence of pain in Joy's hip and the presence of his own osteoporosis. That her pain had somehow, mysteriously, even miraculously, been transferred from her to him. First of all, fact and fiction. In one important respect, the film's admirable understatement was regrettable. namely in its failure adequately to represent the Christian faith of both Joy Davidman and C.S. Lewis. By comparison, some of the factual inaccuracies are of no consequence, such as the presence of only one son instead of the two that Joy Davidman had by her marriage to Mr. Gresham. There was no reference to the trip to Greece that Jack and Joy took with Roger Lanson Green and his wife during the time of respite between the beginning of the illness and her death. Given the film's understandable selectivity, there's a more urgent need for viewers to be informed about the wider and deeper experience of both characters. I came away from the film in the hope that at least the film would increase the desire for people to read Lewis. Walter Hooper says this: "Shadowlands is a beautiful addition to the mythology of Lewis, but it should be taken as dessert. It must be combined with the meat and potato facts of his life. Joy Davidman's own spiritual pilgrimage from Judaism and atheism and communism to Christianity, that's very well documented in Lyle Dorsett's biography, is but hinted at in the film. We're told little about how her own faith sustained her to endure suffering and to face death. In this respect, as in others, Joy's part is woefully underwritten, as one reviewer has said. But in what follows, I want to concentrate upon the portrait of Lewis. So we come to consider the theme of prayer. The place of prayer in Lewis's life is well represented. C.S. Lewis says to one of his friends in the film, and this is a quote from his actual writings, "I can't help praying. It doesn't change God, it changes me." That reflects a view in the sovereignty of God. Prayer doesn't change God, it changes me. One of the tenderest scenes in the film has Jack Lewis praying at the bedside of his dying wife. "Sweet Jesus, bless my beloved wife Joy. Forgive me if I love her too much. Have mercy on us both." Yet it was, to my mind, tragic that the film gives only the weakest expression to the idea that the prolonging of Joy's life for 3 years beyond the initial discovery of the cancer was a result of a divine miracle on her behalf in response to the prayers of many. There is the scene in which the chaplain says to Lewis, "Jack, God has answered your prayers." But that statement stands alone. But if you read the biography of Lewis, you will discover that Lewis asked that the chaplain, the Anglican minister Peter Bide, pray for Joy shortly before conducting the marriage service in her hospital room between Jack and Joy. That's not mentioned. And the biographies indicate that God seems to have done a miracle in prolonging her life for another 3 years. The lesson in this is that in the midst of the experience of suffering, there is no better response than to commune with God in prayer. That's to state it simply, but there is no better response from the people of God. "I say to God, my rock, why have you abandoned me?" Coming to the next theme, love. As movingly portrayed in this film, C.S. Lewis came to love Joy Davidman deeply. His book, The Four Loves, is published in 1960, the year of her death. And it's much stronger and richer a book for him to have from his having had this experience to draw upon. The film is right, at least to some degree, in portraying Lewis as one who knew more of love from books than from personal experience. He says somewhere that he experiences in his 60s what many experience in their 20s. I think this husband's love for his deceased wife comes to its most poignant expression, both in the televised version and in the film version, in the scene where, following Joy's death, Jack Lewis together. One gains no understanding, however, from this film about C.S. Lewis's experience of friendship or philia with a large circle of persons. But the film does beautifully portray the warmth and depth both of storge and philia in the relationship between Jack and his brother. Clay. Yeah. In fact, in the biography by Roger Lancelin Green and Walter Hooper, there is a chapter entitled Surprised by Joy, with this joy being in view. Yeah, many have observed that. Bill?
The way that the second film, pictures him kind of like repeating and people rushing up to him afterwards, that's not a realistic depiction.
No, I think that that's part of the build-up to depict him as somebody for whom pain is viewed as a purely intellectual problem. And so he's almost glibly saying these words as though to say, when he faces the real thing, will this stand up? And I'm about to say something that would suggest, to my mind at least, that some of this is quite deliberate. They want to depict Lewis as a man whose faith never quite rebounded after it was put to this supreme test. Let me give you a quote from a man named Stefan Ulstein in an article in Christianity Today, February the 7th, 1994. What separates Shadowlands from ordinary romances is that it is built upon eros rather than erotica. The central question addressed by Shadowlands is whether it is better to live safely or to risk all for transcendent love. To that extent, the film is to be commended. A man named David Anson, the film reviewer for Newsweek, judges that Lewis's wisdom about pain is purely intellectual before he meets Joy. David Anson is a very acute reviewer of film, but I must say that while that judgment is accurate if the only basis for it is the film, it's woefully lacking as an index to Lewis's life. David Anson says, wisdom about pain is purely intellectual for Lewis. David Anson ought to read his biography about the devastating loss of his mother, about his experiences during the First World War, including the wound he received, his perennial difficulties with Mrs. Moore, his brother's alcoholism, to which the film does make some reference. Here, to me, is the greatest flaw in the film. The film doesn't make this clear that Lewis's experience with Joy did not cause him to reconsider or to abandon the convictions expressed in The Problem of Pain. Rather, the film shows us Lewis learning the very thing he writes and lectures about. Though I think this could have been much stronger. Suffering helps us to grow. It drives us out of the nursery into the world of others. That's a statement from the film. But the film does not accentuate with sufficient forcefulness that the experience of Joy's suffering and death did not cause Lewis to reconsider, much less to abandon, the conviction set forth in The Problem of Pain. Jack Lewis says in the film, "When the death of the beloved gets close, you find out whether you believe it or not. You find out whether you believe it or not. That is, whether you believe the Christian faith or not. To my great regret, the film ends without fully resolving this question." There in the Oxford Common Room, you have Anthony Hopkins as Lewis making this almost savage remark that his loss of his wife had left everything a bloody, awful mess. And I wonder whether William Nicholson, the writer, and Richard Attenborough, the director, are more interested in depicting Lewis as a man of shaky faith and growing doubt, rather than as one whose faith was actually strengthened by adversity. Remember the priest's words of consolation. "You have your faith, Jack," but there's a hollowness to that statement within its context. Lewis's belief in the reality of heaven is not absent from the film. After all, the film is called Shadowlands, which is an implicit statement of the character of this life in relation to the next. When Douglas Gresham asks Lewis following the death of Douglas's mother, "Do you believe in heaven?" Jack answers, "Yes, I do. But one wishes that this conviction were more strongly affirmed, especially at the film's end." If I had been the producer or the director, as the film came to its close, I would have written into the soundtrack the closing paragraph from The Last Battle. But given the way the film journeyed to its end, it would be preferable to include statements that Lewis wrote after the death of Joy, preferably from A Grief Observed. And I'd like for us to look at that at this time. When Lewis wrote The Problem of Pain in 1940, he was only 42 years old. In his later life, he was to experience great pain as he identified with his wife, the former Joy Davidman, during her battle with cancer. Lewis's own spiritual struggle is especially evident in his book, A Grief Observed, which he first wrote under the pseudonym N.W. Clarke, which is Anglo-Saxon for no one, upon Joy's death in July 1960. "I reject the theory, although it is fascinating, that this book is essentially a work of fiction. Consider the pilgrimage reflected in the following quotes from this book, taken in order, a sequence which, to my mind, shatters John Beversluys' idea that Joy's death caused Lewis drastically to revise his former understanding of the Christian faith." In a sense, this sequence is reminiscent of the book of Job. Stage one, "Meanwhile, where is God?" This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing Him, so happy that you are tempted to feel His claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to Him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to Him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. after that silence, you may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once. And that seeming was as strong as this. What can this mean? Why is he so present, a commander in our time of prosperity, and so very absent a help in time of trouble? Reflective of this stage in Lewis's journey are his words in the film spoken after Joy's death. I'm afraid of never seeing her again. God knows, but does God care? Stage two. You can't see anything properly while your eyes are blurred with tears. You can't, in most things, get what you want if you want it too desperately. Anyway, you can't get the best out of it. Now, let's have a real good talk. Reduces everyone to silence. I must get a good sleep tonight, ushers in hours of wakefulness. Delicious drinks are wasted on a really ravenous thirst. Is it similarly the very intensity of the longing that draws the iron curtain? I have gradually been coming to feel that the door is no longer shut and bolted. Was it my own frantic need that slammed it in my face? The time when there is nothing at all in your soul except a cry for help, maybe just the time when God can't give it. You're like the drowning man who can't be helped because he clutches and grabs. Perhaps your own reiterated cries deafen you to the voices, to the voice you hope to hear. On the other hand, knock and it shall be opened. But does knocking mean hammering and kicking the door like a maniac? And there's also, to him that hath shall be given. After all, you must have a capacity to receive, or even omnipotence can't give. Perhaps your own passion temporarily destroys the capacity. Stage three. Am I just sidling back to God because I know that if there's any road to H, and her first name was Helen, it runs through him. But then, of course, I know perfectly well that he can't be used as a road. If you're approaching him not as the goal but as the road, not as the end but as a means, you're not really approaching him at all. Lord, are these your real terms? Can I meet H again only if I learn to love you so much that I don't care whether I meet her or not? Consider, Lord, how it looks to us. What would anyone think of me if I said to the boys, no toffee now, but when you've grown up and don't really want toffee, you shall have as much of it as you choose. When I lay these questions before God, I get no answer, but a rather special sort of no answer. It is not the locked door. It is more like a silent, certainly not uncompassionate gaze, as though he shook his head, not in refusal, but waving the question, like, peace, child, you don't understand. Consider the progression in the book of Job. The effect of the mighty revelation of Yahweh in chapters 38 to 41 is that Job is absolutely overwhelmed by the greatness of God. His questions and answers to his questions no longer matter. The questions now seem trivial when compared to the overpowering splendor of the holy, majestic, and mighty God.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U, at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.